Hello and welcome back to the Good, the Bad and the Just Plain Standard podcast. Today we are happy to welcome the producer and host of the Buzzword podcast, co-founder of the Halfwits Theatre Company, the man who popped my Waiting for Godot sherry in Glasgow recently. All hail Aaron Robert Penny. How are you all right, mate?
Right. Thank you. I've never had that kind of an introduction. That was a mouthful.
There you go.
Thank you for having me.
So I was the only one who of us three that went to see Waiting for Godot, so we couldn't make it the focus of this episode, obviously. Thus, the movie version of Glengarry Glen Ross came about.
Yes.
But before we delve into the movie, let's talk about a few things I touched while I introduced you. So Aaron, you're an actor. You've got your own production company, your own podcast about theatre. What's your journey from falling in love with theatre to actually crushing it in the industry today?
Crushing it? Briefly, I did a degree in photography and spent all my time with the performing arts section. And then it was a push to go home and I was bored in my mind. And then I got thrown into an acting class at Strathclyde Theatre Group. And did that for about 4 years and then came out at the end of it with a bunch of friends and fellow actors, one or two who are on the podcast with me, Stuart McDougall. And you start with small plays in wee local community theatres and then it just keeps on going and going because once you get that bug, how do you stop? And you just keep on moving and then you start working with Strathclyde Theatre Group and then it just balloons from there where I met fellow actors, Gary Hur, and then we set up our own wee theatre company off the back of that after the success of doing something like Glengarry Glen Ross, Reasons to Be Pretty and Rope. And we just thought, well, let's do it ourselves and put our own money into it and see what comes of it. And we're two plays in now and the podcast just came of, I think, boredom again. Stuart, Chris and myself were all podcast fans and for all the talk we thought let's try it ourselves and do something that spins off of what's going on in theatre and acting in Scotland but mainly the Western Scottish belt and see what we can get there and get people in to talk about theatre and what they're doing and then we're all fans of film as well so we generally digress onto other topics that have no meaning or bearing on the topic of that night but we do that once a month as well. And yeah, and the last production was Waiting for Godot at the Glasgow International Comedy Festival. And that just finished back in March. And since then, I've been taking a break to try and get some new ideas going.
So you've produced the version, so that you said Glengarry for Strathclyde Theatre Group. How did this come about? Why this and how did it go?
It was when I was doing The Winter's Tale with SDG. I had to do a lot of my scenes with Gary Hur and we were just riffing backstage while we're waiting to actually go on stage and all we would do is talk about our favourite plays, one being Glengarry. One thing leads to another and I went home, went online and went, are the rights available? They were, surprisingly. And then I called the theatre and I went, you got any dates available in about 6 months' time? And he went, yep. And that was it. I made a phone call to Gary and says, listen, it's available. The dates are available and SDG will fund it. We produce it and direct it ourselves. And that got the ball rolling. And really, it was just out of the love of the play and the film. But we wanted to do things our way and reinterpret it just a wee bit. And that was really the beginning of it for us. And we were just hoping that we thought with a name like Glengarry, it's synonymous with the theatre. And if you don't know the theatre play, you know the film. And that'll maybe drag some audience members in. And we were just hoping for a good audience. We never thought for a minute we'd actually sell the play out every night that we were there. And I think SDG were thankful of that one. But we pulled together a really good cast of actors outside of SDG as well. And some of whom have stayed with us since then and came back and reprised other roles or taken on the director's seat for us with other productions as well. So it's in the last 3 years it's been a continuous little roller coaster of one play after the other, but we seem to always pick plays that have maybe a film or somewhat of a wider audience to it, which has been maybe a wee bit of our success with what we've done because it's got a wee bit of recognition factor to it. So it's been fun, if not stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Did this production then have some stuff that you've never seen before, like some novelty things?
With Glengarry, yeah. If you know the film, like you've got the famous speech that Alec Baldwin does, where he comes in and totally berates the other characters for about 5 minutes. And one of the first discussions that Gary and I always talked about was getting that speech, that scene into the play. And that was like, well, how do we do that? And what we also felt was that the play without that speech doesn't build up the context of what the situation is for the characters. And you go in cold in the play straight into the conversation between Levine and Williamson, which is Jack Lemmon and Kevin Spacey's character. And we felt it's good, but let's set the scene. So what we did was we says the first thing we do is we get the actors out in front with the audience and sit the actors down with the audience. So we left one or two seats empty, and then Gary played the character of Alec Baldwin, and he came out and he literally berated us like Alec Baldwin does while we are sitting with the audience. So the audience get the barrage as much as we do. And I'm sitting there like chain smoking and being a complete... I played the Ed Harris character, Moss, so I was being a complete and utter asshole. So I'm allowed to swear on this, is that okay? Yeah, that's good. And he gave us that. So we thought that was engaging, and it gave the audience something they liked, which was the movie. And it was this classic scene that we just threw in right at the very beginning. And then what we also decided was in the play, the first act is always in the Chinese restaurant, but it's always intercut between the three scenes that play within it. So you get two characters, then the other two characters, and then finally Roma and Link. We always felt there was too much of a break, so what we did was we made it seamless by introducing a waitress, a non-speaking role. And what we just thought, what we can do is we can end once, when one of the scenes is about to end, we just shift it a wee bit, we bring on the waitress who serves a drink, and as she serves the drinks, one of the character pays as the other characters are walking in, and it just allows us to continue the scenes without ever stopping and starting between them, which a lot of productions do. And we just felt it allowed it to flow better, and it gave us a wee bit fun to play with the characters, especially with the James Link character, who Roma cons into buying the land, because in the play, he doesn't arrive until the third scene of Act One. And he says, it's a Chinese restaurant. He'll just be sitting there by himself for the majority while the other guys are talking. So let's introduce him earlier while the other characters are talking. And he just sits there doing nothing, and then Roma comes in. So we played with that. We broke a few wee rules. But we just felt it was better for a more seamless transition, and nobody ever complained. So we just took advantage of it. And then the second act is in the office, so it runs out in real time. So we just kept that as it was. But it was little subtle things that we just wanted. And also the actress who played the waitress also played the cop, because we wanted to introduce more female actors to the play. We actually wanted the Alec Baldwin part to be played by a woman. But no one would take up the role. But I love the idea of a woman coming in and telling a bunch of guys that it takes brass balls to sell real estate, but no women would do it. So
You should message me next time.
Yeah, we did
Bull, and you were Carter.
Yeah, so I've done that.
So that's a fun role.
Yeah, that was so much fun.
I actually watched the hashtag MeToo version where it's Christopher Plummer instead of Kevin Spacey. But
all right, okay.
Yeah.
I forgot about that joke.
Yeah, the room.
I was wondering if Spacey was going to come into this.
Yeah, but yeah. So now I'll just start by saying that I watched it in my young years, pretty much, only because Al Pacino was in it.
Yeah.
I loved it right away. I still do. I had, however, no idea why I liked it so much. Now, watching it with my 2016 and acting coach Scotland and Natalie Cole eyes, now I get it. Glengarry Glen Ross 1992 film. The French title is just Glengarry. They didn't bother. Yeah. From a play, obviously, by David Mamet. And he also did the screenplay. It won the Pulitzer Prize, the play thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Did you? I don't think you were around in the era where there were only four numbers in telephone numbers. 2306 is a short phone number that they use at some point in the start.
Oh. So
anyway. Yeah. Why I now watching it right now, I realized why it will probably go into the rating that I will give it at the end. There are three quotes in there that pretty much shaped how I see life. Always tell them the truth. Easiest thing to remember. That always comes back to me, this one. You want to learn the first rule? You'd know if you ever spent a day in your life, you never open your mouth until you know what the shot is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are all Al Pacino lines.
Yeah, I think I know what the rating is because Al Pacino's in it, yeah. Wait till we get to Jack and Jill one day.
Huge fan.
I don't know why. I've read the play. I hadn't seen the film until we watched it for this. I don't know why the line, coffee's for closers.
Yeah.
I was like, I've definitely heard that somewhere in pop culture. Probably for The Simpsons or something back in the day, yeah. But I was like, why does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
It's kind of...
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great line. I'm like, oh, it's a great
quick
line.
And easy.
Put the coffee down. Yeah, yeah. Coffee's for closers only.
Something I also understood for once, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not sure, and I've listened to everything that was being said, that's a weird title, right? Glengarry Glen Ross. Mm. So is that because they used to have the good business with Glen Ross Guy the Farms, and then that's the new Glengarry Island thing?
I think, yes. It's the land that they're selling, and it's one against the other. It was like, these are the new leads, these are the Glengarry leads, and you don't get them. And then Glen Ross is another property that I think they do previously sell, but I don't remember ever being mentioned. There's probably somebody out there that knows why, and I should know it. But it is to do with the property they're selling in Florida, in the Florida Keys.
Mm-hmm.
David Mamet likes to have his title weird, like Oleana has nothing to do with what's inside the play.
I talk about that play because I went to see that and it literally turned my insides out. I was ready to have issue with the female character. I wanted to kill her, but that's a tough one.
Yeah.
But still very good.
Mamet.
I thought you wouldn't like Mamet Jan because of his quote about French films, which is, a story has a beginning, middle and end, except for French films where you put them in any order, and that's why French films suck. I was like, all right.
No, but what I do love about Mamet is Awakening. I don't know if you've watched his interview with Ben Shapiro.
No.
That'll be interesting.
Watch it. It's okay. Great. Yeah, yeah. No need to expand on that, right? But it's great.
Like, link in
the description, probably.
Like, he wrote a long time ago a book called Secret Knowledge, and that's when he stopped being a brain-dead liberal. That's the whole about this. Mm. Very interesting stuff. I haven't read the book, but the interview was great. I think I like this movie because it was now watching it, as I said, with more... aware eyes. One of the first time that you're being led towards some stuff, and they don't tell you everything, and then there is kind of a twist. Shelley is struggling to get the sales and
the money for his daughter.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, but there's really Moss and Alan Arkin characters, like, and in the end, you get, but Moss actually asked the two guys to get the, and the one and not the other. Well, it's very, very well done in the movie. I haven't read the play, but in the movie, I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
The play works pretty much in the same format, except the first scene is just Levine, Shelley Levine and Williamson, the Spacey and Lemon characters. And it's just Levine constantly going, John, give me the leads, help me. And then, then you go to Moss and Aaron now in the Chinese restaurant, and it's just them chatting, and of course Moss pretty much blackmailing Aaron now into doing the theft. And then of course you get Roma doing his speech to Link, the poor guy that says nothing, and then you just move into act two, which is after the robbery. But it's the film, I think, does a really good representation of the text and between just jumbling things up before the actual robbery itself. But I knew the film before I saw the play, and going back to read the play, it was just like, it plays so well to it, and I thought they did a great job.
I mean, it's all about the words, so you'd hope that they would be true to the play, because, I mean, Mamet's all about subtext, right? So it's what they're not saying, or what's not happening, really.
Isn't it the basis of all our coaching for the whole year, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where it all comes from.
Our coach was very into Mamet.
But you guys are all acting Coach Scotland.
Yeah.
Yes.
They really push the kind of, I'm going to get really actory, is the practical aesthetics approach to acting.
Mindsets and stuff.
Yeah, reading what's in the text, playing off of that, so it allows it to always be fresh in your head.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Play the words, not the method of your character, so
yeah.
to speak.
Yeah.
And I was like, because that's, I think I was counter to that being at SDG was, it was the other way. It's like, where's your character? What's your situation? And where have you came from and where you're going?
Yeah.
So it was that kind of thing when you go to do Mammoth, suddenly you're like, it's all on the page. He wants you to play what is there. Mm-hmm. But I know that was Acting Coach Scotland. So it's always curious for me. I was like, how does that work? Because I come from a slightly different kind of learning, so to speak.
Yeah. It's always good to know what works in the play that you're doing or mm-hmm. the film that you're doing. I feel like if you keep on doing the same thing over and over again, it might not work for a certain play.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, like, because sometimes mindsets don't work for me because I don't need it, because it comes, either it comes naturally to me, I know exactly how to play this character because it's me, or I know someone like that, mm-hmm. or it actually helps to write down, you know, the, what's it called?
The
given circumstances.
Oh, yeah.
And then you can get the character. But I feel like it just to have the, like, different sets of tools, depending on where you are, is really helpful.
I think some of the things that can confuse people with the way we were taught anyway, is that you do so much analysis of like what's going on in the script, where the drama starts, where's the turning point, what's the climax. There's a lot of stuff going on there that you latch onto that in the end, you put it away, because if you're aware of that happening, it takes you out of the moment of doing it.
Yeah.
So it's very much of prep how to get into it. But once you're into it, leave it to one side. So it's difficult for some people that don't have that analytical to go like taking it all apart. And then for people that are impulsive as well to go, I've got all this already, but my impulses are telling me to do an opposite thing.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of both. I think it's quite useful because it is good to know where you're going in the story, because I think it helps me as an actor go like, right, I know what the journey is, so I know that why this moment, this particular moment, is of essence for an acting thing. Mm. But it does take away from the moment of instinct. Although I remember in training, one of the best moments I ever did is I fell over doing the blocking and you just roll with it. And I'm like, well, that's exactly,
hey,
that's the thing. You do all this, you get all this prep, and then something happens on the night and you go with it. And it's like, that's the best you've done. It's like, we didn't get taught this.
Every show I've done, something's happened where I was kind of like, that wasn't supposed to go down. Mm-hmm. But we were doing Waiting for Godot on the second or third night, and one of the characters has to pull out chicken to eat from his basket. And we didn't realise that when the character had fallen over before that part of the scene happened, the chicken had fallen out of the basket already and went off to the side of the stage where we didn't see it. So he went looking for his chicken. There was no chicken there to eat. And that was a problem, because that was a part of the scene.
Mm.
And literally, I'm telling the actor, who's Chris, who had to eat the chicken that wasn't there, and all he had on him was a nub of a carrot that he was eating. And I says, and I leaned into him because I had the availability to it, and I says, eat the carrot. And he goes, I've already eaten it. And I was like, eat it again? And it was just, mime it, make something up. It's in 2 minutes, you're supposed to be eating a chicken. It's not there. Good luck.
Mm.
And really, he mimed his way through it. And the audience knew, but it's like, commit.
Yeah,
there's exactly. Nothing else to it. But that's the moments where, and even when we were doing Glengarry, I've talked about this before, it's that you react in the moment. I was in the scene with Stuart, and we were playing Moss and Ara now. I totally forgot that Link was going to be walking on stage halfway through our scene and sitting down. So I suddenly heard somebody walking behind me, and all I could think in my head was, who the fuck is walking on stage? You don't do that. And I turned around and went, oh yeah, he comes on. And I was like, totally forgot. So in the moment, I'd literally forgotten about what the scene was about. And I was like, but my reaction played perfectly into the scene. Mm. So I was like, roll with it, just keep going.
Yeah.
And I was like, different every night.
Yeah.
It's funny that this anecdote you just told, because about Godot, so I was entirely, even though it was written in French, I've never read it before. Yeah, who knew? Something phenomenal happened. I'm sure it's on purpose, because obviously it is. on my solo podcast, the first episode is about Waiting for Good. And I don't know if you listened, but
I had listened to just.
And I'm, so stuff happens. You know, there is obviously theater and cinema etiquette, right?
Yes.
And when people go to the restroom and.
Yes.
During the entire first act, people were going, was like, well, nobody, what the hell? Isn't there like etiquette? And at some point, there is this line. The famous one, nothing happens, nobody comes, nobody goes.
Yes.
And that's when I realized that that was part of the play.
Yes.
That was great.
Chris will be so happy. It was his idea. It was always, he always had this line, and he asked, can I just step down off the stage and deliver it to the audience and break the fourth wall? Because we always played with the idea that we're speaking to the audience or looking out to the audience. And then he was like, can I really just leave the stage and come down and go, nothing happens, and do his wee bit and then come back into the scene? And he was like, that was all Chris. He just, he desired to do that. But no, the people walking off in the first act and deciding in their droves to go to the toilet whilst we're on stage, yes, that's a sin against humanity, that one, and it's a crime and I hate it. And there's nothing we can do about it. But we say to everybody, turn off your phones. Some people don't. People decide that they're going to have a pint of alcohol before they go into the theatre for the next hour and a half, and their bladders can't handle it. And it's like, why?
It's interesting, the dynamic. I've got a similar story, because I did a scratch night, which was a difference between scenes, monologues, and they had slam poetry and short stories as well.
Yeah.
So the dynamic that must be between poetry nights, where people do like come in and out, compared to like say monologues, because that was happening while I was doing this like 5 minute piece, and you could see people leaving. I'm like, as an actor, it throws you, because you've been taught the whole, you watch it, there are points to leave, but it must be the different formats that must just be all right in these poetry nights, which is when it mixes, you're like, oh okay, but it's like, where do you stand on if it's a bit of everything? Even though there were breaks, actually, there was like maybe like 40 minutes and there was a break and another 40 minutes and so on. So,
yeah.
But
we've had audience members that have been late and don't seem to understand the fact that when the play starts, they don't get in. And that's a rule that they've have forgotten exists. So it's something we always try to maintain, but it never happens. But yeah.
Yeah, it's written on all the tickets. No late comers admitted.
No, yeah. It's on the website as well. But no, in Godel, that was tough. We got that once or twice, and there was nothing for it. Just keep going, ignore it. I've had mobile phones go off. I've had somebody use their GoPro to film the entire show in the front audience while we're on stage, when they've been specifically told not to film it.
That is shocking.
That's mental.
And what am I supposed to do? Is stop the production, drop character, go off stage, pull and snatch Bob. It out of his hands and go, you can't do that.
Pull a Bob Dylan.
You've got even better now. We could have someone just come and drop a 360 degrees camera in the middle of the stage.
I would be surprised. There's nothing that can't happen in theatre, so yet to happen, but probably will.
I did that, not in the middle of the stage, but for the drunk Shakespeare in New York. Uh-huh. They were fine with it. And I was the king with my mum. We paid like $500 to have those seats. So I was like, yeah, I'm filming this.
When in New York.
Yeah. When, yes. Wow.
Yeah, no, I was. That's fascinating then, because in the second act, it stopped all the going. And when I went to see it, I was in the end reflecting back on it. I was pretty sure that it was included in the production, that people were going in and out, and because that was pretty intense. When the day I came, it was like every 10 seconds. So what, really?
Well, was it like a sporting event, like in a rugby match, where everyone goes up and down, up and down, up and down?
I think people just spent too long at the bar.
Yeah.
There is a quote that you can see in one of the walls. Salesmen are born, not made.
I have got that one written down right there as well.
Yay!
Now I get to say that it's not always true, because it's known in my family that I could not sell a glass of water in the desert. I'm just like, nah, that's not my thing. And I'm probably the one of my siblings who sold the most bottles of my mum's wine, actually.
Oh, because of the... Yeah, that's a really good point with the networking and the gifts.
You have a confidence to just go up to someone and say, hi, I do this, here's my card, call me, I'm off.
We've talked
about... I just don't have that, and I need to take a few leaves out of Jan's book,
we've
definitely.
We've talked about that before, like, obviously the continental thing that must be in, like, a lot of people in the European continent. Like, in Britain, we have this thing of, like, we don't approach anyone at any event, ever. Jan just square, plain so as you much. Like, go walks up to Irvin Welsh and invites him on the podcast. I'm like, what? I was like, anyone in Britain, we're like, no, we'll email you.
Yeah.
I passed Peter Capaldi on the street, and I was just, Capaldi. And I was like, can't see anything. Exactly. Just keep on walking.
I know. It's so tough.
You have to know like the underground history. I would immediately have reminded him when he did Acid with Craig Ferguson and Havelock Street.
I'm more curious about this French wine. What kind of wine are we talking?
Oh, yeah.
It's all colors. It's from Provence. And I can send you links. And
it's good.
I like wine.
Yeah, me too. It's really good.
I'm the grape in the grain, which is the worst kind of mix you can possibly get. But I like a glass of red wine and then a whiskey just afterwards. So
oh, yeah.
The worst kind of hangovers, but...
I can imagine.
Well, you don't get to do the sacrilege. You know those red, students, the red cups in the US? Like the, when they do pink... like
pong, yes, yes.
Yeah, wine were inside of that. No, and...
Has to be a wine glass.
To get back to Glengarry for a second, because whatever.
This is what it's about.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nice because it's obviously easier on the production when you don't have 20,000 different locations there. You just have the office, the car, the Chinese restaurant, and a shot of the street.
Yeah.
Which is quite nice. I don't know how the unity of location plays out in the play, but
Chinese restaurant, then the office. That's really it. We designed it that way, and it was saving grace that we went for a kind of minimal set with the Chinese restaurant, but we just tried to give it a sense of colour putting in big long drapes of red with Chinese symbols on them. And instead of having small individual tables, we just had one long kind of breakfast table kind of idea with multiple settings on it, because we thought we could get away with that. You see that a lot in Chinese restaurants where it's like Wagamama style. Mm-hmm. So we kind of implemented a wee bit of that into it. But I've seen different productions, most notably the one at the Theatre Royal, where they did more kind of like the booths, it kind of sectioned everything off. But even then, I think it's brilliant for a production set, especially in a theatre, because you've only got two to really work with. And it makes it a hell of a lot easier. But I think, especially with the film, the one thing I love is the production design on it is all the rain that you get, because the play's set in Chicago during the winter, so it's supposed to be like snowing. And then when you go to the film, it's set in New York, but they substitute the rain for summer rain, because they were filming during the summer. So they just literally had every scene of that in the night before the robbery. Everything is washed in that kind of blue rain with the red, which I thought was fantastic.
Do you have any plans to, do you ever bring back productions? Because I was kind of gutted I missed the most recent one.
I would do Glengarry in a heartbeat for the rest of my life. I love doing it. Sadly, Mr. Mamet thinks differently. He's literally stopped all of his productions. His rights, sorry.
I remember this. This
was a whole thing, because he kind of felt that if people were going to, I think was it, take liberties with the text, then he wasn't going to allow it. They had to do the plays to the exact letter the way he had written them, and no deviation whatsoever. And so because of that, he decided to pull the rights to a lot of his plays. So it's now kind of like you've got to be very patient, very nice, and very hopeful that you get the right to do one of his plays. But no, I would do Glengarry in a heartbeat. I loved it. We had a great cast, and funnily enough, everyone goes for the Ricky Roma part, the Al Pacino role, and I kind of had my heart set on doing the Williamson role, played by Spacey, and then I got cast as Moss, the Ed Harris role, and I was like, God, another asshole. I was like, I'm typecast, and then I fell in love with it, and I was like, I could have done that every night. I could have just went on and did my rant, and especially in Act Two. Where he comes in and just literally lays siege to everyone and curses everyone under the sun. And it was a blast to do every night. And just, it got a lot of your aggression out of you. So by the time you were done, you were like, great, I'm cool for the rest of the night. No anger management here.
Yeah.
That's pretty much reaching the end of my notes for the movie. So do you guys have... you have a notebook full of, I don't know what.
No, I just took notes, and it's like the Lemon character, Jack Lemon playing Levine. It's, he's one of my all-time favourite actors. So it's like everyone goes for Pacino, but I'm a Lemon, Jack Lemon kind of guy. And it's heartbreaking by the time you get to the end of the movie with how the situation that he's in, and it's the subtle manipulation that's constantly going on with all the characters that always draws me to it, and that he's broken at the end, and yet he's still so desperate. He'll sell everything he has, and even when he's lost, he's like, I'll give you everything. And it's the salesman in him, keep going, convert the motherfucker.
Yeah.
And it's like, then that's what he tries to do to Spacey Williamson, and it just doesn't happen because he's playing against the very people that know what he's doing, so to speak. And I always love that about that character.
No, yeah, clearly watching it now, the very touching stuff from Jack Lemmon, yeah.
Yeah, the adult.
Yeah.
I'm such a Jack Lemmon sucker. Just every, I love this like bumbling like
enthusiasm.
Yeah. It's just maybe it just reminds me of such a like a British thing, like Jack Lemmon and it'll come back to me.
Tony Curtis.
Yeah, there's another one. Oh my god, it will come back to me. It's fine. But Jack Lemmon is my favorite because The Apartment's my favorite film.
Yeah, with Shirley MacLaine.
Yeah. Oh my god.
Have you ever seen A Day of Wine and Roses?
No.
That's a tearjerker.
Oh, really?
That will break your heart.
Oh.
That is Lemon at his best.
Really?
Yes.
Is it older?
No, he's younger. Mm-hmm. This is, I would say, his finest performance, but it's a tearjerker. I forget the actress. They both went up for Best Actor at the Oscars, and it really is a crushing film about alcoholism. And
okay. If
you talk about the great performances, watch Lemon in that, and I've yet to see anybody that surpasses it.
Really?
Yeah. There's two or three scenes within it which are just crushing, and but it's I have it somewhere in a DVD somewhere, and I've only watched it I think twice. It's like Schindler's List, you know. It's not the movie kind of movie you pull out to for enjoyment factor.
Yeah.
No.
But no, I love Lemon in this, but there's barely a bad actor in it. There's barely a weak performance, not just because they're all on top. Even Alan Arkin playing Aronow, there's a great bit I love in Act Two where Levine comes in saying he sold, you know, 70 grand to the Nyborgs. I love the names. And they're like, and then you just see Alan Arkin as Arnold go, Christ, I had them in River Glen. It's like the desperation. He loses out there. He can't get a break on anything. And I always loved that line.
As an actor, like watching it, I was thinking if I had those lines, I would never have thought to have done that with them. Like the genius of not having that many exciting lines, just like that. And oh yeah, no, like everything's monosyllabic almost, but he has like it's such a sad desperation that you just feel for the guy so much because he's just got nothing.
It's in contrast to Al Pacino where I was watching this going, I can almost see the billions upon billions of YouTube monologue videos of people trying to be Al Pacino in this film or Alec Baldwin as well.
Yeah.
Just trying to recreate that for note to note, which is the one thing as an actor you'd never do. If you get a role, don't watch other people do it if you can't separate your performance from that.
Well, funnily enough, somebody actually did that when we were doing the auditions for Glengarry. Somebody came in and did a perfect reading of that scene as Al Pacino. And I was like, well, that was great. But in the back of our head was like, we don't need Al Pacino.
Yeah.
No. We need something new. And you just played Al Pacino there. That was a great impersonation, but not what we wanted. And I was like, sorry, but no.
And that's what makes that character so interesting. Because you see these lines, you're like, how are you making these work? And you're bringing this whole person to life, and you can read so much into it when it's, and you can't recreate that as an actor, I don't think.
No.
That's what makes all these performances really good, because there's only going to be one version of these performances. And if at some point they did another film, because I mean, Disney are redoing all theirs, so there might be a generation when we start redoing all the stage shows. I mean, we did Les Mis. I mean, West Side Story is getting one next year.
Spielberg's done that.
Yeah, so Matt might kickstart a whole play renaissance on screen again, so you never know.
God forbid.
Some are not as good as others.
I'll share my views on Les Misérables at some point. It's planned. So I finally started to read the novel.
Oh, good luck. You'll be there for about 6 months.
Yeah. It's a big one.
It took me about a year to read.
Yeah.
I don't think I've even tried.
You had, it's not related at all, but we are magic fans and here. You had someone in your cast in Godot who's a magician.
Yes. That is Aubrey. He played the boy in Godot, and he's never been on, up until that point, he'd never been on stage before with a production. He's actually just won some award for speaking as part of a nationwide tournament. And he is a magician enthusiast with card tricks, and he's learning the sleight of hand. He will hate me for that because I've not given the right terminology on that. But it's the best I can do, because he was getting very specific with the kind of card tricks that he likes to play with. You'd have to ask him in more detail about it. But yes, he is an enthusiast of that art. So he's an interesting character.
I can help because I've read the blurb.
You've got more than...
Yeah, it's, and we talked about this. It's kind of an art now, a cardistry.
Okay.
So it's basically juggling. Well, not exactly, because it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Which is, there are a specific type of card tricks that I don't like. I'm not crazy about cards, but it's pretty to see all those cards moving in all directions. And
I think if anyone's skilled at anything, like very skilled, it's always interesting to watch, even if you've never heard of it. Like, I could watch somebody probably like make sandcastles, and if they can make amazing sandcastles, you're like, hell, you see the sandcastle this guy's just made? And then you waste an hour on YouTube like, oh, I'm watching sandcastles. What's going on?
YouTube, yeah.
There is an actual term to describe what that is. In French, it's fioriture. I don't remember what it is in English, but basically, yeah, it's moving the cards, and it's not card tricks, it's card moves more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the term in, but yeah, I was there. Skilled. Oh, that's nice. Magicians everywhere.
No, it really, watch this space with Aubrey. That boy had no fear. Coming into rehearsals, he was just a bundle of energy. And got with it straight away with all these older guys, and just was ready to play. And he asked the right questions, and he just knew where to go. He took direction well. And when he came on stage, when I was doing the scenes with him, and I swear I could see the fear in his face. And it was one or two nights where even my pal Stuart came to see it, and he says, "When you fell, man, I felt it." He's like, "You fell hard." And I was like, "I nearly had him this night." And he played the part, and it was a small part, but it's pivotal. And it's like you wish there was more parts for somebody of his age to come on stage and do with. And I was like, so definitely he'll be coming back onto the theatre soon. If not, I think he's chosen his career is going to be on the stage with being a magician or an actor or both. But he was superb every night he was on stage. He turned up on time. He learned his lines. I was like, all you can ask for an actor.
Definitely.
To be there.
I don't know how it is in the actual play, but I loved... So you've got this character, Lucky, that doesn't speak.
Yes.
But then he switches on for like 5 minutes.
Yes, that speech.
I loved that. That was great.
That was hellish.
Yeah.
David had a hell of a hard time with that speech, and we had to break that down into, it's nonsense. It's like three speeches mangled together into one. And when you read it, you're like, what? And you literally kind of just speed read it. When you first read the play, and you're like, what the hell is going on? And it's funny, like when you look at something like Glengarry Glen Ross and how the text works with Mamet, it's like, no, yes, go, back, whatever. And it's this constant tete-a-tete between the two characters. Yeah. And that's, in a way, Mamet's his own language. And then when you go off and do something like Godot, it's not even a new language. It's he breaks every rule with how you write a play and the wording. And I could really... getting into the nitty-gritty with this, I won't bore you, but there were some lines where literally he would purposefully change how you would naturally say something. And I think it was just to fuck with the actor, to annoy the hell out of me. Definitely. Because there really was moments like that, and poor David had this 5 to 6 minute monologue where Chris and I are in the back rolling around fighting with each other as this madness continues. And he has to keep his focus on it all the time. And then this whole fight going on. And then at the end, we're fighting with him. And there was so much to it. But the line learning on that one and him trying to keep his focus every night, we were all in applause to him. Even some of the the audience members came back and says that was their favourite bit. And I was like, God damn it. He doesn't say anything, and in a minute he does, everybody loves it. So it's the same kind of thing. He stole the show in some ways.
That's like Jan. He's quiet for 6 months and then comes on The Fringe and everyone's like, who the hell are you? Like, where have you been for the last 6 months?
What?
Yeah, we touched on practical aesthetics before earlier in the podcast. I really struggled with that. I think I really needed a real paying audience and to stop focusing. Okay, so I need to speak up and cheat. I need to, the lines, then I'll just, you're like, the steam from the ears, like, you have no idea at the end. And that's one thing that was important to go on. The Fringe thing was great because in standard drama schools, it's at the end of the year or something. Mm-hmm. That was in the middle, a full run at The Fringe. That was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I love having a paying audience in there. It puts it up a level for you. It's like there's no escape from it at this point in time. The minute you're on stage in front of a paying audience, it's, funnily enough, it's like Glengarry, you know, where Blake says, it's like, go out there tonight, you're going to sail, and you're either going to make the sail, you fuck or walk. And it's theatre's that. It really is that. Yeah. You better go on stage and give them something, because if you don't, you're a dead man.
Mm-hmm.
And their silence is crippling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Stuff to add.
We all probably went into a harrowing moment. Yeah. Remember that time when I bombed? Yeah.
Remember when I thought that tactic was a good idea and it just didn't land at all?
You try the line a different way and you realise there's a reason why the director told me to do it a certain way.
I felt that would work in the moment, but oh no. Yeah.
And firstly, there's this thing that English is not my first language, so I was struggling a bit. But if I'm being honest, it was a bit of a pretext because I'm okay. but now I'm reading stuff differently, where I'm actually focusing on every single thing. Mm-hmm. Where before I was just reading it, so okay, I have that to do now. I can see the subtleties and a bit more, which I did see in here, which I did not necessarily see before and all that stuff. Do you feel you have anything else to add on Glengarry, on Godot, on theatre, or adapting theatre to movies?
Oh my God,
that's a hell of a long.
We got time. We'll be here for another 3 hours. Glengarry. I love the subtlety that goes on with not just the play but the film itself. It's the characterization that builds between them all, and I love especially the second act when Al Pacino calls him his Roma, because you don't see a lot of Al Pacino. He's hidden, especially at the beginning of the movie. He just keeps on cropping up and cropping. They keep him out the scene. It's like, we know who Al is, so let's keep him out. And I think that's one of the brilliancies of the play and of the movie itself, that it keeps its big gun to the back for a lot. It allows the other guys to come forward into the movie and play off of each other, and Al Pacino just comes in and explodes. And it's what's funny is the play is like harsh and it's brutal and it's got some exceptionally racist lines in it that, funnily enough, when I went to see it at the Theatre Royal, they actually cut it from the play. And there is, I know what line they cut because it was Mossy's line, the line that I had, and it is an exceptionally terrible line to, and I won't repeat it while we're live on a podcast. But
I can't even think what it could be. The only one I can think of is Roma's line where he about says, Chinese. Let's go to the Chinese.
You fuck little kids.
Yeah. He goes, sees, do you want to go to the, I don't know if I can say it, but let's go to the Chinese restaurant, but he calls them something else.
Yeah. The Scottish version of that most people argue fancy having a shortened version of Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah, that line. Uh-huh. Yeah, a wee bit.
I'm sure we can say it because it's not like we're saying it ourselves, but that might be murky territory.
Context is important.
Editing's a brilliant thing.
It is, isn't it? That won't be there.
Anyway.
But that's the difficulty of it. That it was something that I really, because we argued about this, and because we said, are we going to cut any lines? And I said, no. This is the play, this is how it was written, and that is the time. It's set in the 80s. This is a play you actually can't, like a film. It's not a film that works now. Because they steal all the phones. Mobile phones would ruin the concept of the play.
Yeah.
So you can't set it in any other period other than one that predates mobile phones.
Mm, or cameras
in that sense. So you have to get rid of, that doesn't work. So it really is a movie that has to stay set within the 1980s. You could set it in the 70s if you want, but it's fascinating the fact that it forces you to keep it within a certain time period. And then it says, no, that's how they were in that time period. That was the attitude and that was the mindset. So you have to play to that. So we didn't cut anything from the play.
Mm.
And nobody seemed to take issue with it because you're acting, you're doing a play, but yet that most recent performance I've seen, they cut it all. They made it exceptionally PC. And I was even debating whether or not they were going to cut the Pacino line from Act Two, where when Williamson screws him and he just turns to him and says, "You're a stupid fucking whatever."
Yeah. Yes.
And,
all right.
You know, I said, are they going to cut it? And they didn't, but it was, but that was the thing. The film doesn't cut it, but the film did cut the more racier lines that the Moss character says.
Right.
And I was like, where does it begin and end? And we kept true to the original text, but we didn't see any real issue with it. But no. So, some people seem to. And I was like, what's right and what's wrong?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Theatre is going that way even more, especially with the involvement of how social media now plays into the theatre, even in advertising. That every Fringe show, I mean, we had Naive Theatre on, which at the end of their show, they were like, if you've enjoyed it, please tweet about it, like that sort of thing. And it's as a show, their Bin Laden show and War of the Newts didn't need that. Like the word of mouth alone would, you know, and the critical praise that especially War of the Newts got, right up wise.
Do you know about the Bin Laden show?
I've heard of it just from like the Fringe. But I haven't been to the Fringe in 2 years just for this. I've missed the last couple of years going through to it. So, but I had heard of it. Chris has been going back and forth to see it. So it has been mentioned to me. But
so it's like a one man show. Yeah. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
And I think people need to start like seeing the difference between an actor and their character and not see like, oh, because I'm saying this, it means that the production company thinks that this is okay. Like, I think that's such a weird balance. Like, you can't.
Yeah, because they did it so well. I want to go and see. And Jan, you showed us the tickets are available for the Adolf, the Hitler version of that show almost, which they told us is really clever because he like starts off by like coming in and taking off the mustache and telling jokes. And the show is that way. Like he slowly turns you and goes, see if you can laugh at that. It doesn't take much for me to convince you that I'm speaking sense. So I want to go and see it to see if they managed to do that with me. Like, does
jokes
that,
become
does
more racist and then you start laughing and then you're like, oh wait, that was actually really, why exactly. am I laughing?
Well, I'd say it would work because have you ever seen Downfall?
Yeah.
You feel sorry for him.
Yeah.
You're heartbroken for this guy who's lost everything. And then you got to remind yourself who it is.
Oh, wait a minute.
And then I was like, God, got to me. And I was like, no, he deserves everything that's coming. But it's obviously it's the exact same thing.
And I think Bin Laden was like that. You're watching it and you're like, oh, poor guy. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, my God.
Yeah, you take that flight. Like all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Like, go for it. It's like, oh, wait.
I think it's dangerous as well because theatre begins as a commentary. Like it's the whole purpose of, one of the purposes of theatre is to give you an idea, make you think. Like we dabble in writing plays and I always try and go in saying, I'm going to try and write something from the opposite viewpoint of me because I know what my own viewpoint of this is. Can I explore it with the opposite idea and can I make that work? Because it's all about, if you come out of a theatre thing and a theatre performance, you're not thinking about anything that you've seen. It's like, I don't know if that's to do with what we're going to see now, especially if stuff is beginning to be censored, or if it's down to, you know, whoever directs or what the message is. Because there are some tour things, obviously, you put them on because the name of the show or the playwright, people will come and see it. I mean, like a David Mamet play will not have any issues being sold out.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, why are you putting it on?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are you trying to say? And I think that's so important now that try and say something more than just come and see them, my show.
Well, funnily enough, I did a Neil LaBute play. Do you know Neil LaBute?
Yeah.
Okay. And I love Neil LaBute for the film In the Company of Men.
Mm-hmm.
If I could get the rights to that as a play, I would love to do it. But that's more of a personal piece. It's like to play with that text. It's never been released. But we did a play called Autobahn by Neil LaBute, and I had to do the scene where it's the guy that has kidnapped a young girl and is taking in a car journey to his cabin somewhere, undisclosed. and that's a nice scene. And it starts off just two people in a car, and then slowly it builds, and you see there's something wrong with the guy. And then by the end of it, you're like, uh-oh, she ain't getting out of this. And that's how, and you never see where it goes, because it's just, you see 10 minutes of this trip. And on one of the nights after I performed it, a guy came up to me and says, dude, I wanted to punch you. Like, you, good, I got to you. That's the point.
That's the point.
I got under your skin, but... the threat is really, people did not like me. And like when the scene ended, the other scenes got a clap. My scene, you could have heard a pin drop. It was so cold, and is that they did not like that scene.
Yeah.
And I was like, it does put them on edge, but it's that kind of thing that gentleman Stephen Duffy, who directed that, who's a professional actor, really pushed us to do something with that scene. And it was that kind of thing. The audience didn't like it, but I was like, well, you weren't supposed to. If you liked that scene, I would worry more for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, there would be some people says, no, you can't put that on stage. And I'd be like, I don't think you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did in drama school, we did it after the end, which is all about.
Oh, yeah.
We were the two characters. It was all about kidnapping a girl.
And rape.
And rape. And we did that scene.
And also a rape that you see, like, from beginning to end. And also, because we were still studying, the whole time people were like, what the hell are you doing? Like, we're still stuck. We can't have a rape scene. And we were like, we're doing this.
It was part of a 20-minute assessment. So we did the final 20 minutes of the play. And we went first of all the groups.
Oh, yeah, we went first.
So the final 10 minutes is the very end scene. And even from us as an actor's rehearsing, we're like, oh, we'll get there. And like, no time did we get every line 100% right. Because when we got there, it's one of the few times you felt a moment. Because you go through the whole... stress and anxiety of performing, you add that onto what you're doing, who you're acting with, the relationships and all that sort of thing, and you get to that really heavy end scene. It's hard. And it's important. It's like the questions that all raise, it's like, it's important to do thought-provoking theatre now, so more than ever, I think.
I saw a production of that, these called Ride Art Centre. It was a friend of mine, Colin Campbell, sorry, that directed it, and I had him on my podcast, and we were talking about it, and it was one of the points, we didn't talk about that specific scene, I think we talked about it afterwards, because I don't know why you really have to start talking about rape for 20 minutes on a podcast, but I asked about the actors, and I was like, how did they deal with that, and he says, what did yous do, because really the two actors are on stage and it's very physical and there's no hiding it. And he goes, how did you build to that? And he says, we didn't. It was the first thing we rehearsed. We got it out of the way because it was the hardest thing to do. And it was that kind of thing. We did it, but we didn't talk about it, so to speak. We just got on with the work. And then once it was blocked and rehearsed and seen and I felt good with it, we moved on because it was so hard to watch. This is the interesting thing as well, say, is I don't think a play like that works in a big theatre.
No.
Because the audience become detracted from it because there's that distance from it. Whereas you go into a theatre where it's only 100, 200 people and you've got something like that playing in front of you, there is no escape.
No.
And suddenly you're with them as if you're part of the scene, and that makes it more intense and more fascinating, which is the same as like Glengarry. We placed it right in front of the audience, like a film does, you know. It's very intimate. It's just one or two people, and you're trying to engage with the audience so that they feel something by the end or hate you.
It's also so to connect the two, after the end, you have that scene and then you have another scene. So the audience is forced to stay with the after effects of it as well, which is why it was so intense, because it's like, okay, don't clap now because we have another scene to do. Like, I literally like left the room and then we go into the prison scene where I'm meeting him. And then it's like a sit down conversation of just like, okay. And then the audience is there like, we have to sit through this after that. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's insane.
We made the point of, because obviously the before the end, she escapes and you think, oh, that's going to be the end. And we made the decision of having me redo the set to build into the prison scene. So you're like, why is this keep going? That should be the end. And just to solidify the fact of like, oh, there's more to this. It doesn't just end with the... And then she escaped. Like, you have to deal with that really heavy scene. Like, it's the best part of the play, the after effects, obviously after the end for the title.
Yeah.
But it is, as an actor doing it, it's the most intense, Because even if, even the, there's the whole thing of when actors like, oh, you're aware you're performing, and the bliss is when you're not. And I think that's one of the few times that we've been there, of the whole, we've forgotten we're acting.
You're just in it. Yeah, you're
in it. And it's a rare experience. And when you're in it, you're like, oh, this is it. But and the funny thing is, you don't realize that until you're done. You're like, oh, shit, I was there.
Yeah. That was me.
Yeah.
There is a production of After the End at the Avignon Festival this year.
Oh, really?
Okay.
That's July. So that's the month you're supposed to be trying to come in Provence. So maybe we could.
Oh, I'd love that. I would love that.
It's one of those ones, if it's on, you got to go and see it.
Yeah.
And then you'll never want to see another theatre play again, or for a while, and then you'll think about it again. You go, yeah. I got the other one. I love it, but yet I can't help but think about it. Is The Pillow Man?
Oh yes, yeah.
And there's talk about Colin out in East Kilbride Arts Centre, who did After the End. He wants to do it as a production, and I was like, oh right, are you sure? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, okay, see if you do, call me.
Yes.
I am both afraid and at the same time can't help myself but to dive into that play and see what you could do with it. And I was like, but I'm still afraid.
A friend that I met in Seoul when I went to see Hamlet in Seoul, produced and directed, I think, a year ago in the US, Blasted.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Sarah Kane.
Yes.
Oh, I forgot which one. Sarah Kane. Yeah, okay.
Is that the one?
Yeah. Psychosis.
Which one's that again?
Psychosis is the one that everyone knows.
Oh, yeah, that's the one.
Is that the one in the hotel room?
No, it's one in the hospital. Sorry, Blasted.
Blasted, there's war outside and there's a guy being sodomized with a Kalashnikov thing.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, that's Blasted.
It's the one about, I know the one about the queen and her son and the, I forget the...
Oh,
do you remember when you were worried about saying arsehole at the beginning of this episode?
Yeah.
We're really getting into it.
This earned the explicit label on all available platforms.
But the thing about Sarah Kane as well is that, like, she had mental health problems.
Yes.
And she put, like, a lot of her anger and fears and her paranoia into, like, any play. So if you hear Sarah Kane, you know the play is going to be really messed, like, really, really messed up.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like, back to Mama, it's like, Oleana, I just picked up Sexual Perversity in Chicago.
Mm. And
it's one of his first ones that he ever did, and it's a four-hander, two guys, two girls, and it just jumps between scenes, and it's about one guy meets a girl and it's everything goes and the other guy's an asshole, and it goes back. He's just not a nice guy. He's pretty much a misogynist, or acts like he's a misogynist, and without giving the whole story away, but it's early Mamet, and I was reading it and I was like, it's good, but it's not a context for today anymore. I think it's old hat. And I was like, for any Mamet fans out there, sorry. But I was reading it and I was like, I don't see the hook of it anymore. It's like, but Kane, I was like, I wouldn't touch this with a barge pole. It's too much.
It's too much.
Mm. I think it was her, like, the first time she directed, and it was filmed because for a degree thing. So I've seen it online. Reading it, it was like, really?
How would you stage this? Why it's like, are we staging this?
One of the scenes is the rats take the body and drag it off stage, and I was like, rats?
Yeah.
And you have to perceive how this happens. I was like, okay, and that's just one of the wee bits in this, in this scene.
So Glengarry is self-contained.
We're back to that's a shift.
That was just.
I wonder what this episode is going to be called. Can't call it Glengarry anyway.
Glengarry was pretty much self-contained. Was there kind of another play that followed, or is that was just that? Do we know?
It's a one-off.
Yeah,
it was a one-off play.
Okay, because Waiting for Godot. Endgame came afterwards. It's kind of a sequel, apparently.
No, it's not. It's a completely separate play, but it plays off the same kind of motifs and standards, where it's existential, and we're not on Mamet, we are on Beckett. I'm getting lost here. But Endgame, it's the same kind of style, where he plays with existential themes and the end of the world and characters and that sense of what it's all about in life, but he plays with it in a different way, where you've got one guy that's held within a wheelchair and has a servant, then there's two people that live in dustbins. And it's a difficult play to read, and I've only read a section of it, and the synopsis of it to try and get an idea of it. But like Goro, it's one of those plays, it's one thing to read it, it's another thing to perform it.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there is a production of Endgame with Alan Cumming and Daniel Radcliffe for the Old Vic next year.
That would be worth it.
I'm going to see that. And we talked about Endgame recently, so I'm going to read you an incredible article I've just found. Staging Endgame has always required obeying to the letter Samuel Beckett's strict stage directions. The American Repertory Theatre of Cambridge, Massachusetts, found out the hard way when, in 1984, Beckett successfully sued them for setting the play in a subway tunnel instead of the mandatory bare interior with two windows and a door. Mm-hmm. The playwright's estate enforces these rules to this very day. These strictures make Marvel Studios' film adaptation of Endgame all the more remarkable. The Russo brothers have redefined what it means to take liberties with the source material. Beckett said the play should be in a single interior, then we're going to use the whole universe. He ordered that there should be only four characters, then we're going to use hundreds, possibly thousands of them. Oh, and about those famous lines of dialogue, we're going to go ahead and write a completely new script.
What?
This is an overt reversal of the stasis experienced in Waiting for Godot, the prequel to Endgame. Estragon's line, "Nothing happens, nobody comes, nobody goes," it's awful. The apparent diametric difference doesn't disrupt the thematic convergence of the two texts. "The whole place stinks of corpses," says Ham in the play. "The whole universe," corrects Clove. In Marvel's Endgame, this central image is explored by means of intergalactic travel as the heroes travel to space only to find, or often create, new corpses.
Wow.
Could you imagine it?
Superb. I love that. How to connect Waiting for Godot and Beckett's Endgame to Avengers. That is excellent.
I wish they'd been brave and the first 10 minutes of Endgame had been like the beginning of Endgame by Samuel Beckett. Just everyone's like, what? And they're like, we're only fooling.
Scarlett Johansson in a dustbin, that would have been perfect.
That was written by Giovanni Tiso, who is an Italian writer and translator based in New Zealand. And I'll link the full article.
Wow.
Yeah. That is super.
Very good.
Do we feel we have stuff to add, or we can go to the plugging?
I mean, I had one thought extra, which was the cinematography of this was, I don't know if it was strange to me because I'm watching with the mindset of like, this is a play that is now a film, which is its own category. Because you're not really watching this film for the way it's shot. You're watching because the dialogue is the key player in this. Because some of the shots were interesting, but then some of the times I was like, this is a bit convenient. But it didn't throw me off. Like, there was a nice shot when he was on the phone and then
camera pans around and it goes behind him and then shows you Spacey coming out the door.
Yeah, all these great shots. But then sometimes it was like, it would hold on too long. And I was beginning to think in the same way of how blocking works. It's like, if you stand still for too long, the audience gets bored. And in this medium, the way the camera works is kind of the blocking in a sense. But apart from that, I don't really have any critical thoughts.
So there were moments you were bored?
Well, not bored, but I'm like, I wish there was another angle. Like, using the medium of cinema, which is exploring things in a three dimension in that style, would have been a bit interesting. But
yeah,
it didn't take away from anything.
They played to the text.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also feel it because there's some shots, especially between Aronow and Moss, where they cut. Boom, 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 boom. In between them, and I'm like, why don't you just go on a two shot, keep it wide and keep them both in frame and allow them to work the dialogue? And it was like, because it's so disorientating, constantly jump cutting between every actor for every line, let the lines play out. And it was like, sometimes it's like the choices were perfect, lovely camera moves to get the actors in and how it's about him, but it's about him. And they play it, especially between like Williamson and Levine. But then with Moss and Aronow, you get these jump cuts.
Yeah.
And it was like, sometimes it works and then sometimes it doesn't work. And it's like, sometimes you're playing for the text and then other times you're not.
Like in the car, it was like, it would hold for a long time, then it would cut and then immediately jump back. I'm like, why did we need the cut if we're going to do it this way? Like, it's like if you wanted to just stick the camera in front of the window of the car, I mean, that would have been a bit more dull, but you would get both the dialogue going, but it's a choice. It doesn't take anything away, but it was the one thought I did have when I was watching the movie going, some of the shots are a bit, I wish there was more to it, but.
Maybe it was to like add to it being jumpy. Like,
I mean, the content has to be great because it's essentially just talking heads for an hour and 40 minutes.
That's very true.
It's quite intense a film to watch because it is like watching a play because you have to focus, like your whole being has to be like totally in it. And like, I was exhausted after it. So yeah. I was like, oh my God, just listening to talking, like very intense talking.
But I will say the pacing is excellent. Like it does not feel like the hour and 40 that it is. And you get some films that are 90 minutes, they feel like they go on forever. But this is like, boom, oh, we're finished. Oh,
yeah.
So it works.
All right, I'll ask you, being the lady of this group, do you feel the missing presence of women in the film? Is it like that's something that needs to be corrected or changed in that? Or is like, does it suit the play? Is like, you could update it? Because it was an argument, we actually wanted to cast like females in the roles. We wanted Roma to be a woman when we were initially going to put the play on, and we didn't get really any interest into it, and we thought it'd be a nice juxtaposition to mix the casting up and just play with it a wee bit and see what worked with it, if it rose the level of intimidation that now a woman's got the top spot and playing these guys at their own game and can beat them at it. And we thought that would be something to add to it. It never worked out, just simply because no one came forward for that part, but I'd be curious. I'm always curious to know. It's like we've tried to always swap some of the casting in our plays with the genders and give some of the main roles to women where it hasn't been there before, especially with our play called Rope. And it's even for the future, it's always a thing we're looking for. And I'll be curious, what's your thoughts on it, especially with the movie?
So watching it, I didn't at all think like, oh look, they're all men talking, because sometimes you feel that immediately, like oh god, there's only men, and being brown as well, like oh god, white men talking, oh I've seen this before. But because it's so clever and because they're all like different characters, you don't feel like it's, I don't know, like there's a reason why they are the people they are. It's not about them being like, oh, because everyone in Hollywood looks that way. It's about, these are characters and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So, and if you maybe put a woman saying those lines, it might not work because women might not speak like that or they might not act that way. Mm-hmm. But if you were able to change it and make it like certain, like if you wanted to be like, maybe change certain lines so that it works for a female character, then that would be really interesting. But sometimes if a woman says something and it might not work, because that's okay. Like this whole thing of like, oh, let's just put a woman in this, and if it doesn't work, then we'll just keep it going. That can also be wrong.
Mm-hmm. For the sake of diversity, there's...
Yeah, that's what I meant. Like, that's kind of can be seen a mile away when it's like, we have to be diverse and different. But if like the actor's good and it comes across as like that, of course that would be really interesting. Because when we did Bull and I played Carter, there was no reason for Carter to be a man, right? Because like, of course, there is no reason, like I don't have to be a man. And it worked really well because I could also bring that like feminine quality of being like extra venomous, you know, in like sort of even more manipulative. And there are certain things that women do that are like in a more insidious, like venomous way. But I think I think maybe the lines might have had to be changed to make it work. Because when I was watching it, I never thought like, oh, they're all men. That's a shame.
An all-female Bull would be interesting. The only bit of Bull I'm thinking might not work, but it would work, is the scene when they're like the six pack, but then you just have a muscular woman. So that totally does work. So an all-female version of that would be really interesting.
I do know an all-female version of Glengarry Glen Ross has been done.
That's interesting.
Well, Jan, sorry, I see you nodding. You were on that one.
When I was looking for thumbnails to the thing, I've seen a picture of the older. Yeah.
Because I was about to say that would be interesting, because then it's about how women interact with each other and how like you maybe can bring out the bitchiness of it, or there are different aspects of that you can bring out. But yeah.
No, it was interesting because I was having a conversation with another actor and she was talking to me about it when we were initially going in to do auditions for Glengarry. And I was like, yeah, we really want to do, but we would like to bring in some females into the roles, and we think we might just need to tweak one or two of the lines. And she was like, why? And I was like, I really don't know. And she really just put the nail on the head and kind of really forced me to think about changing the lines. And we were like, do we really need to change the lines? And I was like, I don't think we do.
No.
Unless there's a line that specifically is directed towards gender,
yeah.
And where we switched it. And there was one or two lines that the Moss character had where we felt we can just tweak it and just make the slur different because we had a female playing the cop.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that element, it was just like, there wasn't really anything we needed to change. And it was like, we found that quite freeing going into the auditions. It was like, yeah, just play it as it is. It's up to you what you bring to it as an actor, and we'll tell us whether or not we think it works or not for the play.
Yeah.
And I was, but it's always, and she kind of just put the nail on the head for me. I was like, okay, we'll just go with what we're doing, go with our gut on it. But it's always interesting. And even the plays we've done since then, it's always been the same. It's like, it's not about so much man or woman playing it. What do you bring to it first? And then let's see if that gives us something that can just bring it up a notch, bring it up a level on the acting front.
Yeah, because
go on.
Okay, if I get, as I actually, I've said this point before, so you go.
That's fine, go.
I was just gonna reiterate, like, because you can see that a mile away when, like, it's just been, someone's just been stuck in for diversity and, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that you would ever do that, but, like, it's immediate, and that's why you can't be like, oh, this is a feminist movie because there's a woman in it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But it's very true that, like, women can say anything.
Go out on a Saturday night in Glasgow and you'll hear most of it.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> So,
I was just going to say that that's by, like, the method that we were taught, in the sense of, like, it allows you to bring yourself into an audition because you're happy with what the underlying needs of the scene are, that you can go, I can play any way I want if I know what the end point is, and it allows you to come in with something different.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I was going to say.
And I guess in the audition, you can see which person is good for the role as well, because of course there are, like, people that won't be good for that role, hence audition.
They walk in for and it's like, you'd work as this other character.
Do we feel we can go into the ratings?
Sure.
Yeah.
What's the rating thing, Adam?
So the good, the bad, and the just plain standard, we rate films on a good, bad, and just plain standard categories. Good being, like, a very enjoyable, would watch again film, just plain standard, they didn't really try anything. There are other categories such as, like, vault, if the film is significant value to you. For instance, one of my favourite films is Alien. I grew up with that, so it's in my vault.
There's an Alien 3 thing there that I'm already really curious about, so my eye's already on it. It's just there.
Oh, yeah.
You've already got me hooked.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, Anouk, Jan, and Aaron, good, bad, or just plain standard?
Anouk, you want to go first?
Oh. Good, very good. I would say I could put this in my vault. I think, just because it surprises me like, I've seen it so many times, and I think the first time I saw it I was too young, so I didn't really understand what was going on. But and it's always interesting to watch it in different, like, stages of your life, because each time you watch it there's, like, a different way that you see it. And being an actor myself, you could just tell that every single person in it involved was just, like, genius. So yeah.
Well, it's also in my vault. I didn't know where to place it before, but because it has nothing to do with the fact that those quotes are coming from Al Pacino, but the two quotes I gave are some of the rules that I try thinking about it in retrospect. I lived some parts of my life, so that's quite significant. So, yeah, vault.
I feel bad saying, not bad saying this. Like, because it's my first time watching the film, I think it's good. It doesn't hold the significant value that it holds for you, Jan, but I still say it's a very excellent movie. And of course, I love the play as well. So it's well worth a watch if you haven't, even if you haven't read the play, because I think it's a good introduction to that whole style.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good. And last but not least,
how many movies am I allowed in my vault?
As many as you like.
That's okay. And yeah, that's good. Yeah, it will definitely be my vault.
Nice.
It's, you know, it's simplistic in its filming and its intent. It doesn't do any massive camera moves. It's not laden with trickery. It's very much just the text and the guys and how they play it out. it's simple in its setup, and I think that's one of the endearing things about it. It's not too artsy fartsy, and there's something endearing about it that I love, especially with Jack Lemmon's character, and also the slight malevolence Spacey brings to it with his part that he always does as an actor, which I've loved. And the Baldwin part, yeah, every bit of it is, there's just, every character brings something to it. Even Jonathan Pryce's Link, they all came with something to it, and that's all you ever ask for. And it's not pretentious in any way, even with Mamet's writing attached to it. And yeah, it's one of those things for years, you know, if you haven't seen the film, you know the name. For one reason or another, it's constantly quoted. Even Saturday Night Live had Baldwin do a special on it with elves, for God's sake. So it's kind of like everybody has their play on it, and always be closing. It's ABC. So yeah, it's got to be in my vault.
It's plugging time. Go, go, Podcast Rangers.
Forgot it.
Mighty plug-in Podcast Rangers. Go, go, Podcast Rangers. Mighty plug-in Podcast Rangers.
Every time you do this, I'm like, we need to make a jingle at some point. And every time
we should.
I forget to make the jingle.
Yeah,
so
we should.
So, Aaron, are you in anything currently? You can go as far as to the fringe, because we're not sure when we're releasing this episode. But
no, right now it's reading time. My partner with Halfwits is literally just got himself married, and he's off on honeymoon for 2 weeks to Iceland. So I've just been house hunting and buying a flat. So we've kind of been on a downturn right now, but we're reading plays, everything and everything. I've got one or two wee small plays I'd like to bring back to Webster's maybe at the end of the year, November time, if I can, because Webster's now have the main theatre, but they also have Webster's 2, which is upstairs, which is a wee smaller 50-seater, very intimate, very fringe style venue. And there's one or two wee two-handers I'd love to bring back that I did about 8 years ago, one called Green Julia, by a guy called Paul Abelman, and I'd love to do that again while I'm still young, before I get too old to play it. But, and we're really actually already kind of thinking about next year for the comedy festival again, what to bring on. We'd like to do another production. We've got one or two in mind, but nothing. It's kind of quiet after doing Godot. I needed a rest from it to mentally get back to some kind of normality. So it's all quiet right now, just the podcast. And if anyone is looking for me in a part in something, please let me know. I always like to put a plug out for possible casting. That's always good.
Can you remind the podcast, the Buzzword Podcast?
The Buzzword Podcast.
We didn't say what it was about, actually.
We don't really know either. The Buzzword Podcast started as a kind of platform for people that are interested in theatre, that have local shows, just somewhere to come and talk about what they're doing. And really that was the beginning of it, and it's kind of just morphed on a wee bit from 2 years. We do it once a month whenever we can meet up. Chris is generally off busy filming some advert or music video that he's working on with his director, Brian Ferguson. We put a few up links to his work that he's been doing recently, which has been really good. And occasionally, if somebody else has got another show on, my friend Stephen Duffy, he's directing a new show at the Beacon, which is coming. I forget the name of the play. So that's bad for the plug. Find that name. I've got it on my phone somewhere. but no, it's again, that's what the podcast is really about. But we do digress a lot into other subjects. And I think the next episode, we might even get into a bit of a Game of Thrones debate because there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, there is.
So we thought we have to touch on it just once, maybe for half an hour. Or what is actually 3 hours that I've cut down to 30 minutes because I won't get the guys to shut up.
No, it's very dangerous to bring up Game of Thrones.
Yeah, we try to do that a lot. Jan asked us a pickup for another episode. He's like, so what did you think of season 8? I'm like, I think we're going to have to talk about every other odd season because we can't sum it up in like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
No,
but that was the plan all along.
Well done, Jan.
Awesome. Oh, so I think this was us.
Cool.
We were quite pleased to have you on, Aaron.
No, thank you very much. It's been great.
And we'll see if we do some podcasting stuff, collabs or whatever at some point.
Absolutely.
We're in the same city, so.
Yes. I
know. Nice to finally meet another podcaster in Glasgow.
In Glasgow, yeah.
I think it was something we looked into it about two and a half years ago, and I couldn't find anybody. Mm. And I was like, is nobody doing this? And I was quite surprised. And then suddenly in the last kind of year, I was like, oh, they're doing that. It was Sits were doing their wee thing. Mm. And then something else cropped up. And then with you guys doing this, and I was like, finally, it's starting to build. Yeah. There's a wee society of it. And so there should be more of it. So, no, it was absolutely great to have. Mm-hmm. I was like, finally, I can talk about it with somebody else. It's not just us alone in the dark.
Yeah. Still, people don't really understand what it is. Like, oh, yeah, I do a podcast. Like, what?
So you're Joe Rogan, yeah? I'm like, no. Sort of.
A little bit.
Yeah, you know, well, now it was said earlier that I'm a bit bolder to go see artists and stuff.
Yeah.
I have Bryan Cranston giving one of the lines from The Room.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
It's a good film.
Oh, I've not seen it yet.
Oh, you have not seen The Room?
No, I can't get a copy. I was like, I know of it. I'm wanting to see it, but it's like Chris has, I think, seen it, but Stuart and I on the podcast haven't seen it. So until we get around to seeing it, we're not, you know, it's on the plate of discussions, but until that time I can get a copy of it. So
do we have a spare? Do we have the Blu-ray and the DVD?
Oh, probably. Don't leave without us investigating.
Scouring.
I think we might have a copy you can have.
Punish me for it.
Yeah. It's our episode 100, so it's like, well, somebody else has got to suffer it.
Watch this terrible film.
It's like The Ring.
No, but I wouldn't. Oh. Because sometimes they come in Glasgow that I wouldn't recommend your first viewing in Glasgow because it's so noisy that you've got the subtitles and it's more of the experience rather than actually trying to get what's happening.
Uh-huh.
But well, even on your own, you probably won't get what's happening anyway. But no. I mean, that's a different kind of experience, and you expect wooden spoons and.
I watched The Disaster Artist, so I've got my kind of play into it, I know what it's about, and I've read enough about it. And with the How Did This Get Made podcast with Jason Manzoukas and talking about it, so it's kind of like it's on my radar of like I know enough about it now to when I sit down I'm like holy hell, and it's like, is it true?
Have a wine and whiskey with you.
Well, as long as Jan is giving me some of his mother's wine, I'll be okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry, selfish plug.
Well, this was last year, 2018. I think we could have a yearly wine appreciation episode.
Oh, well, definitely.
We definitely could.
I'm happy with that.
Well, we'll get you back, maybe. I don't know.
That would be superb. Thank you.
Wine appreciation.
So I think we're done.
Yeah.
Thank you again for coming, Aaron. Thank you again for our massive numbers of listeners, which keep growing every millisecond. And that's it. Do you feel you have anything else to add except saying our goodbye?
No,
I think we're done. Is everyone happy?
Great.
Everyone's happy.
Cool. So we were
Adam,
Anouk,
Jan, and
Aaron.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Two quick things before Adam delivers our usual outro. You may have noticed that we release these episodes with guests in two parts now. The main course about the film being discussed and the questionnaire as dessert. We'll do that going forward so those episodes are kept under a reasonable runtime. Also, we've recorded this episode a while ago and the show from Aaron's friend is obviously over, but just in case, because it may come back, you'll have that segment now. Do you remember what your friend's stuff is that you want to plug, Aaron?
Totally gone out of my head. I need to go back onto my phone to get it. So we're putting up a link for it because I'm going to go and see it. I know it's on at the 1st of June at the Beacon Arts Centre. Tickets are about £18. And Stephen Duffy's the director. He's been around for years. He did the Scottish film Small Faces back in the 90s and with Ian McKidd, who's now in Grey's Anatomy and stuff like that, in the Rome series. And so it's like, I would definitely say if you can get along to the Beacon Arts Centre, you'll be sure to get a good show. Stephen knows what he's doing, especially with actors. I've never been so traumatised by an acting class as I did when Stephen ran it. So if that's what he's doing in an acting class, he'll do something special with the show. So I would definitely get along to the Beacon Arts Centre. It's a boxing story about some boxer in Glasgow in the 1930s, I think. For the life of me, I just can't remember the name, so I do apologise. But it's 1st of June. I'm going to go along and see it.
Sounds great.
Sounds cool.
Cool. Yeah. I'm babysitting on that day.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Good, The Bad, and The Just Plain Standard podcast.
If you like what you heard, you can leave us a review via iTunes. If you want to keep up to date with what we're doing, you can check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Good Bad Standard Podcast on both platforms. If you fancy seeing the live streams that we talk about on the podcast, they can be found on YouTube.com. You search for Milk in a Wine Glass. There are other bits and bobs on there too, just to see what Jan's up to during the week. And if you really like us, like really, really like us, why don't you head on over to patreon.com/goodbadstandardpodcast and have a look if you want to support us. Any small donation is appreciated.